Okay, headlines down on the top of Chavvet and Aleph. If we're continuing with a series of questions that are similar to the question that we spoke about yesterday, which is Boy Mine Rabba Mi Rav Huna. Rabba asked of Rav Huna, the Tosfot Arosh points out here that the Girsa has to be Rabba, not Rava, because Rava never saw Rav Huna. Haroeh Keri B'Kesam. Someone who has a seminal emission through a Kesam, Mahu, what's the din? From Rashi, it sounds like the Kesam is simply what it means. It's like a splinter, it's a piece of wood, and the problem, as we're going to see in a second, is that it takes up a portion of the opening or the orifice of the member through which the semen is emitted. But for him, this is not like the question we spoke about with Shpoferet, which is the catheter, and we spoke about having sightings of Nida through a catheter. Was that Mitameh or not Mitameh? That's what we finished off with yesterday. This is, according to Rashi, not really a continuation of that. On the other hand, the Balei HaTosafot, the Tosfot HaRosh, and probably all the other Rishonim say otherwise, and they say that the question of Kesam is the same question as Shpoferet, which is that it's a catheter that's going into the member, and a person has a seminal emission through the catheter. Does that mitamei the individual? Is that like a Shechvat Zera, or a sighting of Shechvat Zera? The question that Tosfot HaRosh asks is, why does the Gemara use the word Kesam here if we already have a terminology for catheter, which is Shpoferet? That is the common term that the Gemara uses. So Tosfot HaRosh over here says that it has to do with the size difference. It says, V'lo nakat Shpoferet, Mishom de Pihama Dachuku. They didn't use a Shpoferet because the orifice going into the member is very small compared to by the woman where you're putting a catheter in there. There's much more space to move the catheter in. And for that reason, it is describing a different form of catheter for the man than it is for the woman. But in that case, it is a similar question, which is, what's the din here if you have a sighting through a catheter, which didn't come out through the member itself? So the Gemara frames the question in the following manner, which is, Mimenu Amar Rachmono. The Torah in Parshat Mitzorah tells us with regards to Tumat, Shechvat Zera, Tumat Keri, that it has to exit the individual. Ish ki titse mimenu Shechvat Zera, rachatz b'mayim et kol b'saro utamei ad arev. So similar to the terminology of Bibsara that we saw by the woman yesterday, over here it says mimenu, from him. So, ad denofik Bibsaro, below b'kesam, does it mean that it exits from him himself and not through a catheter? Or Dilma Hai Mimenu Ashitse Tumato Luchutz. Or maybe the Mimenu is teaching us a different din, which we again discussed yesterday, the distinction between Nida and Zav and Shechvat Zera, which is that a Nida becomes Tmeah even if the Dam hasn't exited her body yet. All it has to do is exit the Rechem, the womb, and she's already Tmeah, even though it's still internal to her. It does not need to exit her body. That's not true by a Zav and by Shechvat Zera, where it must exit the body in order for it to be mitameh, or the individual to be tameh. And so that's maybe what the mimenu was telling you, that you're only tameh when it exits the individual itself. Vafilu b'kesam nami. And even through a catheter, if it exits the individual, you'd still be tameh. Now, the difference between Rashi's explanation, the Balei Tosafot, the Tosafot HaRosh, the other Rishonim, is what is the mimenu demand of you. So the Gemara here explains, Amalei, typically, we should be able to answer this question, Du'atzmo eni mitamei, ele b'chatimat pi ha'ama. The Shechvat Zera is only mitamei when it seals up or fills up the orifice of the member. So the memra, from this you would conclude, dinogeya havi, that it has to actually physically touch that area. And so then the answer would be that you would not be tameh if it's coming out through a catheter. Question is, why is that? So Rashi explains over here that achi yitzei mimenu k'dei chatimat piyamato, that is a shiur. That is giving you an amount, a shiur that has to exit the individual in order for them to be tameh. And now he explains, midyoiv shviura, since it gave a fixed shiur, michlau de tumat keri lo mishum riyahi. From there you would conclude that Tumat Keri is not a problem of sighting, it's a problem of the physical emission that takes place. It is the contact between the Shechvat Zera and the member. That's why you need a amount. It was all about ri'iyah. It was all about a sighting. You wouldn't need any minimum amount. Any amount that exits would have been a sighting. Here, where it gives you a shiur, then it is ketumat kol magaot, like any other tumat maga. When you touch something that's tameh, you need a kazayit, you need a kabeitza, whatever the requirement is, that's because it only conveys tumah at that minimum shiur. The bayi shiura could go and share its nevela umate. De riya choshiv lebi tumat riya lo bayi shiura. Had it been a sighting driven tumah, then you wouldn't require a shiur. Rashi says something that is pretty amazing over here. He says, first of all, there is a minimum shiur for a seminal emission, which is not clear at all from the Gemara, but that's the way that Rashi reads the Gemara. And the deficit, as we said before, going to Rashi, of having the catheter in there is that you don't reach the shiur, because when the catheter is in there, it's taking up space in the orifice of the member. And so when the shikva zera exits, you don't reach the minimum shiur that you need in order to be tameh. Rashi makes a second assumption, which is that once you have a shiur, that's an indication that the tumah is driven by negiyah and not by ri'iyah, not by a sighting. Those are the two assumptions of Rashi, and that's what everybody else argues on. First of all, the Balei Tosafot just say it or express it in the following manner. It's in this Tosafot and the next Tosafot as well, which is that he says, "Valo derech keisam yichol lirot keri harbe yoter michat tibiat piyama." If the requirement of the shiur of keri is the fact that you get to what's called chatimat piyama, the amount of keri that could fill the orifice of the member, even if it goes through a catheter, you could have volumes above that amount. You could reach that amount without any problem. Or, if you say like Rashi, the problem is that the kesam is taking up a part of the piyama, so you're right. At one moment, you won't have the shiur of chatimat piyama there. But over time, that's what will happen. There'll be plenty more of the semen that's exiting, and then you'll reach the minimum shiur that you need. And so the Balei Tosafot are perplexed by Rashi's explanation over here. And that's why they say that the problem or the question is the same as it was by the woman, which is, if you have a catheter there, then the catheter prevents the semen from touching the piyama. And the Gemara's statement over here that you need chatimat piyama, it's not a statement of shiur, it's a statement of nigiyah. You need physical contact between the semen and the chatimat piyama, because that's what causes the tumah to happen. The exit through the orifice is what causes the tumah to happen, but it has to be touching it upon its exit. And the kesam, the catheter being there, prevents it from touching. So now, you have to understand then, how do you explain Rashi in that context, which is that their machloket really might come down to the question of what it means that chatimat piyama. Chatimat piyama is a shiur of sorts, and Balei Tosafot say about Rashi, there's tons of semen that's being expelled here, so why isn't this individual tameh? You've met the threshold requirement that you're saying, Rashi. Rashi must believe that you needed to exit at once from the piyama to attain that shiur. The kesam doesn't allow that to happen. So it happens over time. I mean, there's a sequence of events, meaning the semen exiting. Over time, you will get to the minimum shiur you need, but never at one point in time is the piyama filled with that shiur. And that's what Rashi thinks is the deficit. The Balei Tosafot obviously don't believe that that's the case. They think that as long as there is chatimat piyama that exits, and it's actually even attached, I mean, it's happening in a stream, and so that should be sufficient in order to meet the minimum requirement. And that's why they explain otherwise. That's how some of the Achronim, like the Kilot Yaakov, try to explain this difference between Rashi and the Balei Tosafot as to their perspective on what Chatimat Pi Hama means and why it's influential and how they explain the Gemara. So then the Gemara says, if you are right about this, if that's true, Ali Stor Biziva, then Shichvat Zera should not have any impact when it comes to a zav. Now, so for Rashi, that means that if Shichvat Zera has a shiur, that means that it's not a sighting-based problem. It's a problem of the quantity of semen that is exiting. If that's the case, then when you are a zav is a different emission than Shichvat Zera, than semen. We've discussed some of the differences before. The Gemara will get into it more in detail later. But that distinction is somewhat irrelevant if you believe that they are both sighting-based problems. That means that a zav, who is bal shteriyot, he has two sightings, he has to wait shivanikim in order to be tahor mitumat azab. He has three emissions or three sightings. He has to then have shivanikim and a korban in order to become tahor. He has a single emission of zav. It's treated like shechvat zera. So now, if this individual is already during a shivanikim and he has a sighting of shechvat zera during that time, not zav, shechvat zera, the halacha is that it's soter, that it undermines the shivanikim. Now, if the shechvat zera is a sighting-based problem, meaning that when you see it, when you have a ri'yah, it's a problem, I understand why it undermines the zav. Because you have something where you're supposed to be clean, quote-unquote, from any emissions, and now you have an emission that happens. It may not be the same emission, but it's a problematic emission that will undermine your shivanikim. On the other hand, if shechvat zera is not a sighting-based problem, but rather a negiyah problem, or a, according to Rashi, a shi'ur problem, then why should it undermine the ziva? It's in a different world. It's a totally different character to it. And if that's the case, it should not undermine the zav, just like touching a sheretz or tumat amet doesn't change the fact that the shivanikim of the zav are still shivanikim. He needs to be naki from emissions. He doesn't need to be naki from tumah. And so if that's the case, why is it that shechvat zera undermines shivanikim of a zav? That's the nature of the Gemara's question based on what you concluded, that it's a nogeya problem, not a ri'ya problem. And if you say that, Allah matanya, why do we have a braita? Zot Torah Tazav, Vasher Titze Mimenu Shechvat Zera. So this is the rules, the instructions of what happens to a Zav. And paralleled over there is also, Asher Titze Mimenu Shechvat Zera. And someone who has a seminal emission. So this is the closing pasuk of Parshat Mitzora that summarizes all that we see there. And so Zot Torah Tazav, Asher Titze Mimenu Shechvat Zera, Latam Abba, tells you they're in the same category. Maziva soteret, akshiva zera soter. That hekesh teaches you that just like if you have a sighting of zav, it would undermine the shivanikim, so too, if you had a sighting of shechvat zera, it would undermine the shivanikim. If that's the case, then it's also a ri'iyah-based problem. It can't be an igiyah-based problem. It has to be in the same world of tumah in order to undermine it. Amalei, stira. Wait a minute, if you think the stira issue, hainu taima de soter, I'll explain to you what that is based on. It's impossible to have a seminal emission that doesn't have subsumed in it, that doesn't have little droplets of a zav emission included in it. So what the Gemara is saying is it's not the shechvat zera inherently that undermines the zav, but rather, it is the fact that the shechvat zera is a siman. It's an indication that there's also a zav emission happening at the same time. You can't separate the two. There will always be, when a person is subject to the ailment of zav, then when he also has the seminal emission, it will carry with it also little droplets of zav. Now, even if you say that, the question is, why does that matter? Because if it is subsumed in the shechvat zera, either it's batel berov, or there's a chatzitza, meaning that there's something that's blocking between the tzichtoe ziva and the piyama, which is the requirement you're saying over here in terms of becoming tamei. That is a problem, or that's an issue over here, because the shechvat zera is sitting between the piyama and the ziva. Especially since over here it's possible that the tzichtoe ziva don't even meet the minimum requirement of chatimat piyama. So then you would have to then say that together with the shechvat zera, they meet the shiur. So the Ramban over here suggests that it is min b'mino, and it's not chotzeitz, which is a very difficult statement because of, first of all, is shechvat zera and zav really min b'mino? That's first of all. So that's a big jump or a leap of faith. In addition to that, the Ramban in the previous sugya says that min b'mino is not a way to overcome problems of negiyah. Min b'mineu enu chutzeitz is only when there's no requirement of direct touching. It's just that, for instance, if you have to hold the lulav, so if you have something that's a handle on the lulav, and we say min b'mineu enu chutzeitz, then it's as if you're holding the lulav. But by the lulav, we don't need direct contact between your hand and the lulav. We need you to be holding the lulav. So there, it's a difference. Over here, where we need negiyah, we need physical contact between the body of the individual and the emission, or yesterday's daf, the dam of the isha and the isha herself, over there, mi b'mino in a chutzeitz is not a relevant terminology that matters. In the end, even though it's basar, or it's something that belongs there, that's separating between the dam and the wall of the woman, or over here, between the semen and the exiting from the piyama, then it's a chatzitza. It doesn't matter if it's mi b'mino anyway, even though it's not touching it. And so that should be problematic over here. So many Rishonim view this as being a gzeirat hakatuv, and that the Gemara over here is just giving the reason behind the gzeirat hakatuv. Gzeirat hakatuv is that shechvat zera impacts, and that gzeirat hakatuv is explained by the fact that there are tzichtuchei ziva in there, and that's why that is the case. And for that reason, we consider it to be a problem, even though, again, it's just a gzeirat hakatuv. Elmiato. If that's true, that that's the reason behind why shechvat zera is soter, the shivnikiyim of a zav, then tistor kol zayin. It should undermine the count of the shivnikiyim. Like a woman who is a zavah gdola, and that's the way shivnikiyim, if she has any sighting of dam during those shivnikiyim, it's a reset. And you have to start the shivnikiyim over. We don't just say, oh, you're suspended for a day, and then you continue. That's a reset. So similarly, if a zav has a zav emission, that undermines the all the shivnikiyim, he's got to start again. That's not true by shechvat zera. He has a sighting of a seminal emission while he's doing the shivnikiyim of zav. It's suspended for a day because it's tamei tumas erev. And what we say is the sighting of the shechvat zera suspends you for that day. You lose that day in the count, but then you can continue afterwards. It's almost akin to the difference between Shabbat and Yom Tov with regards to avelut, whereby Shabbat does have the ability to override a little bit shiva, but in the end, it doesn't undermine it. You just continue the shiva afterwards. Yom Tov is something that cuts off the shiva. It stops it. So something akin to that. It's not a perfect example, but something akin to that. Shechvat zera is a suspension. It is not an undermining of it, whereas the setting of zav is. But the way you're describing it now is that shechvat zera's problem is that it has zav embedded in it. Then it's equivalent of a zav emission. Why doesn't it undermine the whole shiva nikiyim? Alama tanya, why do we have a braita? Zotarata zav, maziva soteret, ach shechvat zera soter. Again, the hekesh we have from the pasuk, just like the zav emission undermines the shiva nikiyim, so too shechvat zera does. Ima ziva soteret kol zayin, ach shechvat zera gnami soteret kol zayin. You would think, just like by a zav emission, it undermines it for 7 days, so too shechvat zera should undermine it for 7 days. Tamalomar, at the end of the pasuk, is the tama va. Ein lechaba elama she'amur ba. Whatever is written by it has implications over it here. And therefore, soteret yom echad. Just like the tumah of shechvat zera is only tumah for 1 day, so too it's only soter 1 day. It only loses you 1 day. It's a suspension of the shiva nikiyim. As opposed to zav, if you have zav emissions, you'll be tamei for 7 days. So it undermines the entire shiva nikiyim. So they work in a similar fashion, but each one in its own independent way. So that's why, basically, in the end, it is gzeirat hakatuv, which is amalei gzeirat hakatuv hi. That is exactly what it is. It's a gzeirat hakatuv. The Braita is describing a gzeirat hakatuv, and therefore you can't try to bring logic to it. Ziva gmura dolarva bashichvat zeret soterek kol shiva. When it's pure zav emission, it undermines the entire shiva nikiyim. Tzichtuchei ziva, little droplets of ziva, the arba bashichvat zera, that's mixed together with a seminal emission, lo soteret yom echad. It only undermines 1 day. That is the halacha that's based on the psukim. That is the gzeret hakatuv. We don't have to explain it. That's why it happens. And again, many of the Rishonim carry that over to the whole explanation of tzichtuchei ziva. Why it even matters that there are tzichtuchei ziva is the gzeret hakatuv. But if that's the case, then it doesn't undermine a possibility that shechvat zera is a problem of negiyah, not ri'iyah. And even though over here it has impact by zav, the reason that it has impact by zav is because it's a gzeirat hakatuv. And then maybe, even if it's in the world of negiyah, not ri'iyah, you can still say that the shechvat zera will have impact over here. So, boi minei Rabbi Yossi b'Rabbi Chanina mi Rabbi Elazar. Dam yavesh mahu. What is the din with regards to dried out, coagulated dam that is expelled by the woman? The pasuk says by zava gidola, perek tevav again in Vayikra and Parshat Mitzora and pasuk chavhei, it says v'isha ki azuv zov dama yamim rabim below 8 nidata o ki tazuv al nidata Kol yimei zov tumata, kimei nidata tiet meahi. Amar Rachmana, you hear the word yazov, zov, repeated many times here, which means to flow. So, is that requirement of the pasuk? The pasuk says that it has to flow, ad meidav daiv lei, until it flows, until it's moving. Lachin yaveshlo. That would imply that only when it's moist, when it's a liquid form, is that possible. If it's dried out, it's not considered to be dam. Odilma haiki yazuv zov dama orcha demiltahi. It's not describing exactly how the dam is expelled. It's just telling you what the normal situation is. Normally, blood flows out of an individual, flows out of the woman. But in a case where it happens to come out in a different manner, that doesn't mean it's not tamei. It just means it's not the regular way. The Torah is describing what is normal or what you would expect. But that's not a limitation on the fact that dry blood would be tamei. Therefore, even something that's dried out or coagulated blood would still be considered a sighting for nida. We already learned it in a Tanaic work. Dama nida, ubasara meit, mitamim lachim v'yaveshim. When it comes to dama nida and basar hameit, which also has its own world of tuma and tumat oel, they are mitamei when they are moist, v'yaveshim, and even when they're dried out. Amalei lach v'nasei yavesh lo kami ba'ilei. Says, if it was once moist, and then it became dried out, that I don't have a question about. Because you're right, that for sure is mitameh, because it derives from something that was moist. And obviously, by the case of basarameit, that has to be the situation. By basarameit, you can't have something that is inherently dry. It always had to be from a basar if somebody was alive, and now they're mate. So it was once moist, and once had vitality to it, and now it's all dried out. Similarly, the dam of the nida, that's what's being described here. And I agree with that. I don't have a question about kara. What happens if it's dry all the way along? It never was in a liquid form, meaning that it was discharged when it was already dry. And now that's my question. Hanami tinitua. That also we have in our Mishnah, and that's why it's brought over here. It's because our Mishnah is being quoted. Hamapelet kamin klipa. Kamin sa'ara, a woman who discharges something that looks like a shell, a husk of some sort, or like a hair. Kamin afar, or it looks like earth. Kamin yavchushim, or it looks like insects or mosquitoes. Adumim, again, we said in the Mishnah, adumim modifies all of them. These are red discharges. Tatil the mayim, in order to figure out what it is, you put it into water. Imni mochu, if they dissolve, tmeya, then it definitely is dam. So even though you're seeing something that is dry here, it's pretty clear, a fire is something that is dry. If you're seeing something like a fire, you're definitely seeing something dry. And despite the fact that it was a dry emission, we still say you test it to see whether it is dam or it's not dam. So you see that it is impactful, even when it's yavesh. So you see from this that even if it was dry, yavesh mi'ikara, we still put it in water. If it dissolves, it would be tmeya. Yochi bilo nimochu nami. Kumar says, wait, if yavesh mi'ikara is tamei, then why do you have to do this test at all? Even if it doesn't dissolve, you should be tamei. If something that's dry from the outset is also considered to be dam nida, then why do you have to see if it dissolves back into a liquid? So then why do you need to do this test at all? Rabba says, no, you still need the test. Kilo nimochu b'rir bifnei atzmai. So even when you have something that's yavesh mi'ikara, if it doesn't dissolve at all, then that's an indication that it's a different entity. It's not dam over here. So when it doesn't dissolve, then it's not dam at all. And that's why it would be tehora in that case. But that shows you that dam yavesh, even though it's not flowing, is mitameh. But it does have to be subjected to this test in order to be sure that it is actually dam. Not because yavesh mi'ikara is not considered to be a discharge. Rather because we could even by yavesh mi'ikara make it a determination that it is a birya b'efnei atzma, it's something else. It's not dam hamikor. If that's the case, it should be Torah. And that's why we have to do it. The Rashi seems to indicate that birya b'efnei atzma means it's not dam. It's something else that's being discharged. Whereas other Rishonim, including what seems to be from the Balei Tosafot over here as well, say that not that it's not dam, it is dam, just not dam hamikor. It's blood that came out, we can't deny that, but the fact that it doesn't dissolve is indicative of the fact that it's maybe dam makah and not dam amikor. So it can be blood, it just is blood that is not mitameh tumat nida. And then, conceptually, that's also similar in a machloket of Rishonim as to whether all dry blood needs to be tested, Or is it only the blood that's mentioned in our Mishnah, the items that are mentioned in our Mishnah need to be tested? So that question is debated by the Rishonim over here as to what the test is used for. Is the test only relevant in these types of situations? And that's why we put the test on with the hair and the things that look like hairs, look like klipot, because they're not normal types of discharges. And there's a possibility that they're a birya bifnei atzma, they're their own entity. Therefore, you have to test. But in cases where it's obvious that it's dam, then we don't have to do the test, because we know it's dam, it's just dry dam that came out. And there we don't have to do any test. That's one possible way to read it. The other way to read it is, that's exactly what the meaning of birya bifnei atzma is, which is that even though we know it's dam, if it doesn't dissolve, it doesn't get the halachic status of dam. It becomes a birya bifnei atzma, becomes its own entity, and it's no longer classified as dam, even though it is dam. That means that you have to check, even when it's dam yavesh that's coming out, and you know it's dam, or it looks more like what dam would look like coming out, rather than some of these odd shapes or forms, nevertheless, you would have to test it, because if it doesn't test positively for dam, then it's not considered dam as far as a nida's discharge is concerned, or luckily it's not considered to be dam. That really might depend on how you view what the birya bifnei atzma is over here. If you think that birya bifnei atzma is a total different entity, then that's why over here you need the test. But had it been that it was clearly dam, then we wouldn't have to test it. We know it's dam et bitmea. But if you think that even if it is dam, there's still the possibility that it's dam makar or something else, then you would have to test it even if it was dam yavesh that's coming out because of the fact that that might not be dam hamikor, even though it is dam. Then the Gemara asked, umiika ge'ai gavna. We quoted in the Mishnah about discharges of hairs, discharges of klipot. Are those really realistic types of scenarios that things like that happen? And the Gemara says, it, yes, we have evidence of that. Vatanya, we have a braita that discusses case law that included these situations exactly. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok, shnei masim hela abba mitivin liyavna. Rabbi Tzadok lived in Tivin, which was up towards the lower Galil, and he sent over questions to Yavne, which was the main seat of the Chachamim. Rabbi Tzadok lives through the Churban HaBayit. He's one of the individuals, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, when he gets the three requests from Vespasian when he leaves Yerushalayim, one of them was to get a doctor for Rabbi Tzadok, because he had been fasting for the 40 years or 80 years before the Churban HaBayit, and needed a doctor to heal him. After the Churban, Rabbi Tzadok moves north to Tivin, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and the Chachamim established, and that's one of the things that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai also asked, is Yavna b'Chachameha, and so they established the center of learning, and the center of the Beit Din was in Yavna. So Rabbi Tzadok, who was considered an elder statesman, used to send things over to the Chachamim in Yavna to ask them. So his son, Rabbi Elazar, is describing that his father sent over a question from Tivin Yavna. There was this woman who was discharging these red peels or husks, and they came and asked my father, and my father sent the question to the Chachamim in Yavne, and the Chachamim asked the doctors, and they said to them, Isha zo maka yeshla betoch mea. The doctor said that this woman has an injury, some sort of lesion internally, that is discharging this problem. So that might be the answer, is how do you have dam that is dry from the outset? It's dam that coagulated or is gathering over there and hardening inside of the mekor, and that dam is then hardening and then being exuded. So they said, tatil the ma'im, put it into water, Imni mochu, if it dissolves, tmeya. So they have that same test that we saw before. Shuv ma'aseh b'isha shaita ma'pelet kamin se'arot adumot. And another scenario, again, these match up with what the Mishnah indicates, the types of discharges a woman would have. One, we had the klipot, now we have the se'arot adumot, red hairs. Uba b'shalah et abba. Again, they came to ask my father, Rabbi Tzadok, v'abba shalah chachamim. Rabbi Tzadok sent it to Yavne, to the chachamim, v'chachamim l'rufim. And then the Chachamim asked the doctors, from Lulahem, Shuma Yeshla Betoch Mea. She has a birthmark, a mole inside of her. Shmimena Mapelet Kamin Sarot Adumot. That is discharging these red hairs. And the Rashi says over here, that a mole in general grows hairs. So too, if it's an internal mole, it's growing hairs and discharging these hairs. Tatil lamayim, you put it into water. Imni mocho tmeya. If it dissolves, then it's tmeya. If it doesn't dissolve, then it'll be tehora. Again, they're trying to figure out whether it is or is not dam hamikor. There's a number of things to address here. The first of which is the chachamim shalu the rofim. The chachamim asked the doctors, which shows you that the chachamim were relying on the doctors and the medical information of their time in order to come to a psak halacha. They did not necessarily rely on the doctors for the psak. They relied on the doctors for the information to give them the information that was necessary to have the psak halacha. Now, it might be that they didn't rely on them completely, and that depends on how you read the line here in the description in the Braita, which is, put it in water and see if it dissolves. It's not clear who said that. Is that part of the doctor's instructions and say, this is the reason for these discharges, and if you want to check it, put it into water to double check whether that's the case. That could be the case. If that's the case, then the Chachamim relied completely on the doctors, and they just used the halacha based on what the information they were given, based on the information they were given. The other hand, it probably reads, and it seems to be, that it was the Chachamim's statement to put it into water, which is then, even after the doctors told them the information, they still were not 100% convinced that that was the case, so they wanted to be certain. So they took the halachic instruction of the Mishnah and said, okay, let's apply that. Based on what they're telling us, this should match up with the case of the Mishnah. If that's the truth, then let's test whether they're right or not about it. I mean, the doctors said it as a given, and then the Chachamim said, okay, we don't know if they're right or not, but we have a way to test that. The way to test that is to put it into water and see if it dissolves. That's what the Mishnah tells us. So they had sfeikot about they accepted what they said, but then they put tests in place to check whether the doctors were correct or not, or to corroborate what the doctors said. If that's the case, then the Chachamim would not be relying as fully on the doctors. You can see something like this in the Tosfot Rosh, where he writes over here, the doctors made a statement, and he says, Lo sheya barur l'rofim. It wasn't clear to the rofim that this was the proper diagnosis. Sheya la maka b'toch mea, that she had some sort of injury internally. Dimken afilu imni mochu tahara. Because if it was so, even if they dissolve, it should be tahara. If you can tell me with 100% certainty that there's an injury inside of the rechem, then you don't need to check whether it dissolves or not. It should be irrelevant. Maybe she has a makah, and then check it out by using the water. So what the Rosh is saying is that the Rofim didn't have certainty over here. That's what precipitates the need for the Chachamim to test, because they speculated that this was the problem. They're diagnosing it and saying, in all likelihood, this is the cause. But that doesn't mean it's 100% certain. So in order to be 100% certain, you do the test that the Chachamim had, check if it dissolves. And from the Rosh, it sounds even like the doctors said to do such. But from the Rosh, it would sound like if the doctors had 100% certainty, then the Chachamim would have relied on that and would have said that it is Torah. That's an important machloket in the Rishonim. The question as to who made the statement about the test over here, which indicates how much the Chachamim are willing to rely on the doctors in situations. The big Gemara with regards to that is in the 8th Perek of Yoma, with regards to Yom HaKippurim, where the Mishnah explicitly says that if the Rofim say that the person needs to eat, then we rely on the Rofim and we feed them, irrespective of what the person is saying. The Rofim get to make that decision. So there, it seems like the Chachamim relied on the Rofim completely. You could argue that over there, it's a Safek Pikuach Nefesh, and there we rely on the Rofim, because there it's going to go the Chumrah. The Chumrah means we're going to worry about Pikuach Nefesh. Over there we rely on Rofim. But in other matters, maybe we wouldn't rely on them. Also, the use of the word Rofim in plural is also interesting. Does that mean that we need multiple Rofim to tell us this information before we believe it's true? Is the Rofim just a generic statement about doctors in general, which means that any doctor could give you this information? Or do we need more than one doctor to give the information? All of those are questions that arise out of this Gemara over here. And again, the Rishonim and Achronim stake out different positions, which obviously have nafkamino the halacha, and you see that in many of the shutim that are written about relying on doctors. They reference to this and the question of how reliable or how much can we rely on doctors. Amar Reish Lakish Ubi Postrim. Reish Lakish modifies or qualifies what we said now, that you have to put it into water in order to see if it dissolves. He says you don't put it into cold water or hot water. You put it into warm or lukewarm water, which is somewhat amorphous of a description, because that warm water is all in the eyes of the beholder. It's a subjective term. Again, here, they discuss different possibilities as to what the meaning of poshrim is, but he says it has to be poshrim in order for this test to work. Tanya Namiochi, we have a braita that supports that. Tatil the mayim ubi poshrim. You have to put it into water, you have to put it into warm water. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Mema Achto Birok, you mush it down with saliva, al gabi tzipoin, on your fingernail, that you rub it on your fingernail together with saliva, and that's how you see whether it dissolves or doesn't dissolve. Mai binayu, what's the nafkamina between their reasons? Amaravina, ma'uch, ayidea dechak. If it only dissolves by using pressure on it, ika binayu, that's the difference. According to the chachamim, you just drop it into the poshrim and you watch and see if it dissolves or not. You don't put any pressure on it. You don't move it or smush it at all. Whereas according to Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, we allow you to work it to see if it actually dissolves by being pushed over or smushed over. And that's the difference between them in their test, even though that seems pretty straightforward, that that's the nafka mina between them. Nevertheless, the Gemara indicates that that's the difference of what they're describing here. Hotam tnan, kama hi shriyatan, b'poshrim. How long do you soak it in warm water? Mi'eit le'eit. That's for 24 hours. Here the Gemara is referencing to something we're going to see later on in the Masechta with regards to shratzim. Shratzim are only mitamim when they are lach, not when they're yavesh. So the question is, how do you know when something's moist or yavesh? So the test is, if you soak it in water for 24 hours, does it change its form? If it remains the same, then it's yavesh. It's dried out to the point where there's no meaning to putting it in water. If it was still moist or it still has some moisture to it when you put it in water, it will revive, quote-unquote, the sheretz. Obviously, the sheretz is dead, so it's not going to come back to life, but it'll give it more form, and it'll look more like it did originally. So that's the test that you do. Hachamai, over here, when you soak it in warm water, what's the din? There was a minimum requirement of 24 hours. Mi be'ina made late. Over here, do we require 24 hours? Alone, or maybe not. Rashi says the opposite side, or the other option, is 12 hours. Do you have to wait 24 hours or 12 hours? Sheretz v'nevela da kushe be'inan meit leit. Sheretz and nevela, which are hard and they become solid, then they need 24 hours to really see if we can bring them back to their former state. About dam derakich, blood, which is a softer form, lo, maybe it doesn't need 24 hours, maybe 12 hours is sufficient. Odoma lo shna, or maybe it makes no difference and you need 24 hours by both. Teiku, we leave that as an unresolved issue as to how long you need to soak the item in order to test whether it is dam or not dam. Hamapelet kamin dagim. This is the part of the Mishnah that says that if you have a discharge of dagim, chagavim, shratzim, in remasim, over there, they are not mitamei nida, because they're clearly not dam nida, but they're also not mitamei leida, because it's not a birth that's considered to be a leida. The Gemara's question over here is, v'leflog nami Rabbi Yehuda beha. Why doesn't Rabbi Yehuda argue over here? Rabbi Yehuda, in the first case of the Mishnah, argued when you had the discharge of the chunk of basar, the chatichat basar, or chatichat dam that you discharged. Rabbi Yehuda over there said that even if it's a dry discharge, it is tamei tumat nida. Whereas the Chachamim said it had to have dam on the surface or on the outside or along with it in order to be tamei tumat nida. So why doesn't Rabbi Yehuda make the same statement over here? It's a dry discharge. Why does he assume that it's also a nida? The Gemara asks, "V'lechlo nami Yehuda ba'ha amarech lokesh b'machloket shnuya." He argues in that case as well. And the Mishnah continues with the Shita of the Rabbonon, even though there is a machloket about this issue. The Mishnah began with the machloket, and then it goes on. And then you know, from that point forward, if it's an opinion that goes like one of those two, then it's a machloket, but we're following one of the two opinions. That's one possibility. And then, v'Rabbi Yochanan Amar, afilu tema Rabbi Yehuda. Maybe even Rabbi Yehuda agrees in this case. By a case where it's a chunk that's being discharged, David dam de korish vavi chaticha. Sometimes blood coagulates and turns into a chunk that looks like a chunk of basar. That's why he says you're tamei tumat nida over there. Of Alberia lohavi. Blood does not coagulate and then take a form of a fish. or a locust, or shkatzim v'ramasim. That's not what happens to dam. If it has a form like that, it's clearly basar. And so Rabbi Yehuda would agree over here that she's not tamei tumat nida, and she's also not tamei tumat leida, because it's neither. It's not a leida, and it's not a nida. But it says, ulahach lishno, according to the second lashon that we had in yesterday's daf, damar Rabbi Yochanan, be'ef shal p'ticha de kever below dam kamif ligay, that he explained the machlok between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim in the following manner. In the first lashon, Shmuel and Rabbi Yochanan gave suggestions as to what they thought the machlok was. In the end, it was Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak that made the suggestion that it has to do with whether the rechem, the cervix, can open without there being a flow of dam. That's Rav Nachum Yitzchak's suggestion. In the second lashon, that's the suggestion of Rabbi Yochanan. That means that Rabbi Yochanan thinks that the machloket between them is be'ef shal p'ticha dekever below dam kamif ligay. The Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda argue about whether you can have the cervix, the uterus, open, discharge something, without there being dam nida that exits with it. Biflog nami Rabbi Yehuda Baha. If that's the case, then the same issue arises when she discharges a fish, a locust, or something shaped like that, because it means that the cervix opened to allow it to discharge. If that's the case, then was there an issue of dam that came with it or not? Gemara says, you're right. The one who has that lashon, the second lashon from yesterday's Gemara, over here they have the following lashon. Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish Darmei Tarvayu. Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish both say, b'machloket shnuya v'rabbonon hi. They both have to agree then that it is a continued machloket, and the Mishnah is just following the shita of the Rabbonon. Rabbi Yochanan clearly believes in that situation that the issue that they're arguing about in the first case is the same issue that they'd be arguing about in that latter case. If that's the case, then they still argue over here, and Rabbi Yochanan would also have to say that it can't be Goli Alma. It'd have to be that it is only the Shita of the Chachamim. The Baal Yad Tosafot asks an important question over here, which has relevance to yesterday's daf as well, which is, why does the Gemara only ask on Rabbi Yehuda's Shita with regards to, we have the first case in the Mishnah, which is a Chaticha, and they ask on the third case in the Mishnah, which is Dagim, Chagavim, Shkatzim, V'Ramasim. It skips the case about the Se'arot, the Yavchushim, and the Klipot that were dismissed. Why doesn't it ask over there? Where's Rabbi Yehuda? How come Rabbi Yehuda doesn't argue over there? Gemara does not ask that question. Why is it that it doesn't ask? If it asks the question on all the babot of the Mishnah. So Tosafot over here says, Asa'ara v'klipa lo parich, the liflog Rabbi Yehuda, de mi'u'tim ninu. They're too small. V'lo shayach v'hu p'ticha da kefer. That's not considered to be an opening of the kefer of the womb. What you learn from this Baal Yad Tosafot, and I mentioned it yesterday, is that there is a minimum amount that the rechem needs to open in order for it to be considered b'tichat hakever. Just because something was discharged from the womb and came through the cervix doesn't mean that there was b'tichat hakever. Halach le b'tichat hakever means it has to open a minimum amount. We don't know what that is, but we know it's bigger than a sarah or klipa. It has to be bigger than that. And we know that already the size of a dag or a chagav is already big enough that that's considered to be b'tichat hakever. But there is a minimum. Even according to the one who says that no matter what discharge comes out, if Sarah the particular that here dam, they still have a minimum or threshold of how much it needs to open for that to happen. And that's what the Baal Yad Tosafot is saying over here. The items that are in that second section of the Mishnah are too small. And even if they are discharged, they're not a automatic assumption of Ticha de Kever, even though, of course, the womb had to open to let them out, but they're too small to classify that as being an opening of the womb. As to what that threshold is, it's not clear, and that's what we mentioned yesterday. Maybe the shpoferet is an indication of what's considered to be p'tichat hakever over there, that might define what is considered p'tichat hakever, or the size that brings you over the threshold of p'tichat hakever. Right now, the next part of the Gemara, it speaks about the next piece in the Mishnah, which is Rabbi Meir's Shita, which is that a person is mapele kamin b'meima chaya v'of. If you discharge something that looks like animals, according to Rabbi Meir, that's considered to be a leida. According to the Chachamim, then that is not a leida. Question is, I'm Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a Shmuel, my time with the Rabbi Meir. Why does Rabbi Meir think this is a leida? A leida is a human being giving birth to a human being. Why are animals considered to be a leida? Ho'el v'nemra bo yitzira ka'adam. That's because in the Psukim and Breshit, it describes the animals in a similar fashion to the way it describes man. I mean, the description of the creation of man and animals takes place twice, once in Breshit Aleph, and then once in Breshit Bet. In Breshit Bet, when it describes the creation of man, and the animals, it uses the same terminology, which is Vayitzar Hashem Elokim et ha'adam afar min ha'adama Vayipach ba'apav nishmat chayim Vayi adam lenefesh chaya. That's the first Vayitzar. Later on in that same perek, that was Pasuk Zayin. Later on in Pasuk Yutet, it says Vayitzar Hashem Elokim min ha'adama kol chayat ha'sadeh et kol ofer shemayim Vayivel ha'adam lirot ma'ikra lo kol she'ikra lo adam nefesh chaya u'shmo. So the word Vayitzer, the creation of man and creation of animal, uses the same terminology. There is a difference between them. The one by man has two yuds in it, Vayitzer. The one by the animals only has one yud. And that's what Rashi brings down Chazal on the spot, that the difference is double yud, shtei yitzirot. Yitzirat olam hazeh, yitzirat tirat ha-meitim. The two creations by man, because man has a body or a goof in this world. And then he has B'tchiyat HaMeitim, he's going to have another group. So they come of a Be'ema, Shein Omed at the Din, a Be'ema that doesn't stand trial or Din, it doesn't have to be returned, but B'tchiyat HaMeitim, there's no Yitzirah with two Yudins. So that's what Rashi says with regard to that. So that's, according to Rabbi Yehuda Mashmo, is the reasoning behind Rabbi Meir's position. Eliyata, Hamapelet, Dmut, Tanin, that's the case. If she discharges something that looks like a Tanin, which would be a serpent of sorts, Rashi says it's a Dag Gadol, a large fish, then she should be the mother who gave birth to this. Because once again over there, the term yitzirah is used. Now, the two yitzirah that we just mentioned are in Perek Bet. The yitzirah that the Gemara is referring to here is in Perek Aleph, where it describes in the day that the fish were created, the fish and the birds, by Vralukim et Tataninim Hagidolim, he created them. The Kol Nefesh Achaya Romeset Asher Shatzu Amayin Leminehem, Et Kol Of Kanaf Leminehu, By Yarlukim Ki Tov. So here you have, by Vra, by the Taninim Hagidolim. So maybe that should also be considered as a birth like man. Amre, Danim Yitzira Mitzira, Vein Danim Briya Mitzira. You're using a different word. In Perek Bet it says, Vayitzer, which are the same verb. Over here, it's using Vayivra, which is a different verb. So why are you saying that it should be the same? Or it says, Mainafkamina, why does it matter? Well, Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel, we have this in Torah Kohanim, that the Tana Debei Rabbi Shmuel learns, V'shava Kohen, Abao Kohen, by the Tumat Nigei Habayit. It says over there that the Kohen comes, and the Kohen returns. Zohi Shiva, Zohi Bia. Medrash Alocha has a Gezer Shava between the Bia and the Shiva, to tell you that just like by the case where the Kohen comes, he has to remove Chaltsuet Avanim, that to take out the stones, Patach et Abayit, and then reseal them in with new stones over there. So too, when he returns again, he has to do the same thing. So they learned that from Gezer Shavah between the word Shav and Ba. Those aren't the same word. So why is Vayivra and Vayitzer? If they mean the same thing, it should be enough. They don't have to be actually the same word. Vod, Nigmar, Briya, Mibriya. And then besides that, the word Briah is used over here by the Tanim HaGdolim, but it's also used by Adam, where it says Vayivra in Perek Aleph with regards to Adam. Vayivra Elokim et Adam b'tzalmo, b'tzalmo Elokim bara uto, zachar nekim ba bara utam. So the word Vayivra is used. Have the Gezer Shavavi from Vayivra, Vayivra. And that would work. Now, what's interesting here is that the Gemara and many other places in Shas indicates that the reason that the Gezer Shavavi of Shav and Briah works is because we have no other choice. Meaning that there was no other alternative over here. Had there been an alternative between using the same word or a different word, we'd always opt to use the same word. In a case where we don't have that option, and the only Gezer Shavah available to us is a different word with the same meaning, then we're willing to make the Gezer Shavah that way. But that means that it's an extenuating circumstance, and you can't extrapolate from that to other areas of halacha with regards to Gezer Shavot. The Gemara here doesn't really address it. Addresses it in a side way, which is that you have Vayivra, Vayivra, and you have Vayitzer, Vayitzer. Amre, Vayivra, the Gufei. So it says here, you need Vayivra to teach you the core din that man was created. Vayitzer, lafnuye. Vayitzer is extraneous. V'danim yitzirah, mitzirah. And that's why you learn yitzirah from yitzirah, because that's the extraneous word. The Gemara says, that's all a creation that you just made. You tell me Vayivra is the core word and Yitzirah is the extra word. Adarabah, I could just say just the opposite. Vayitzer the Gufei. Vayitzer is the core word telling you that man is created. Vayivra is the extra word that we don't need in the Afnuye. But done in Briah mi Briah. And we should learn Briah from Briah. So the question is that man's creation is repeated twice, once in Perek Aleph, once in Perek Bet. One of the two is extraneous. Whichever one's extraneous, you can make a gezeirah shavah with. So if you say Vayitzer is the extraneous word, then Vayitzer connects with animals. If you say Vayivra is the extraneous word, then that connects with the Taninim HaGedolim. So which one is the extraneous word? It's not clear which one is the core and which one's the extraneous word. Ella, Vayitzer Mufne Mishnei Tzadim. Vayitzer is extraneous in both cases, meaning both by animals and by man, Vayitzer is extraneous. Mufne Gabi Adam, Mufne Gabi Beima. It's mufne, it's extraneous by man, and it's extraneous by animal, because both of those were mentioned in the Perek Aleph, by Yivralu Kimet Adam Bitzalmo, which we already discussed. And then also we have, with regards to the creation of the animals, V'yaseh Lukimet Kol Chayat Haaretz Leminavet Meimenah Leminavet Kol Remes Adaman Mineu. So you see that God created the animals also. So that means Vayitzer, both by the animals and by man in the second Perek, is extraneous. Vayivra gabi adam mufneh, gabi taninim enu mufneh. On the other hand, when it comes to vayivra, if you were to say the word vayitzer is the core word and vayivra is the extraneous word, then you only have it by adam, that you have an extraneous term. By taninim adolim, they're only mentioned once, and it says vayivra. So they are not extraneous. By adam, you have vayitzer, which is the core word then, and vayivra is extraneous. You only have an extraneous mufneh on one side. So my mufneh gabi beima, why do you say that it's extraneous by beima? Like the pasuk we just quoted, that's the case. It works the same way by the tanim, because it says in Perek Aleph, so the remes hadama also then has a duplicate creation. Because it has it both by Ivra Lukim et Tataninim HaGudolim, and you have also the Remes Adama. The Gemara gives the obvious answer, which is Remes Tichtiv Otam the Yabashahu. The Ramasim that are mentioned in Perek Aleph are not water Ramasim, they are the Ramasim that are on the land animals. And so those are different. Dosfo points out that the answer seems obvious. Didn't they know that that was the difference between the fifth day and the sixth day? The fifth day were the water animals, and the sixth day were the land animals. What was even the question from the start? Now the Gemara says, "Ma'inaf kamina ben mufne mitzarachad mufne mishnei tzadim." Why does it matter whether you have it extraneous on one side of the gzeirah shavah or extraneous on two sides of the gzeirah shavah? Why is there a difference? You're telling me now that I'm better off learning vayitzer as being the extraneous words, because then I have extraneous words both by behema and by adam. Rather than saying that it is Vayitzer, the core words, and Vayivra is the extraneous word, because next there is only the Vayivra of Adam is extraneous, but the Vayivra of the Taninim HaGdolim is not extraneous. Why is there a difference? So the Gemara says, Nafkamina, Damar Yeshua Udu Amar Shmuel. We have this memra from Yudu Amar Shmuel. Rashi says, this machloka that is brought over here between Rabbi Shmuel and the Rabbonon, Shmuel has a Mesora that was the case. We find it nowhere else in Shas as being the source. The Gemara quotes it in other places in Shas, but here is the place for the source for it, and the source is Shmuel himself that has a Mesora that this was the case. Otherwise, we have no evidence of a Mishnah or a Braita that indicates that Rabbi Shmuel and the Chachamim argue about this issue. It comes from a member of Shmuel. Mishom Rabbi Ishmael. Whenever it says Mishom, means that they never saw the individual, means that they have a Mesora that individual, they heard in the individual's name that was the case. Shum Rabbi Shmuel, but you can see here already in the Sotah Shas, he wants to take it out. Kol Gzeirah Shavah Sheinu Mufneh. Any Gzeirah Shavah that does not have extraneous words on either side, on either side, Ein Lemei Dimei Menu. Then you don't learn from such a Gzeirah Shavah. Mufneh Mitzad Echad, if one of the two words is extraneous, Rabbi Shmuel Lemei Dim Vein Moshivin, according to Rabbi Shmuel, you can have the Gzeirah Shavah, but you can't undermine it. Once you have at least one of the two words being extraneous, then you already is a gzeir shava that supersedes logic. And even if there are questions on the gzeir shava, we don't ask the question. The rabbanon lemeidim umeshivim. According to the chachamim, if you have one of the two words is extraneous, then we learn the gzeir shava, but we find a logical inconsistency in the learning of the gzeir shava, we will undermine it. Mufne mishnei tzadim, if both words are extraneous, Divrei Hakol, according to both the Chachamim and Rabbi Shmuel, Lemeidim, Ve'ein Meshivim. We learn the Gzeir Shava, and we don't look at the logical inconsistencies. Even if there is reason to undermine it logically, we do not do so. So now, according to the Chachamim, it's clear there's a difference between Mufne Mitzer Achad and Mufne Mishnei Tzadim. Mufne Mitzer Achad is a Gzeir Shava, but then it's subject to testing logically, and it can be undermined. Mufne Mishnei Tzadim is a super strong Gzeir Shava, and you cannot undermine it. For Rabbi Shmuel, Ma'ika ben Mufne Mitzer Achad, Mufne Mishnei Tzadim. For Rabbi Shmuel, why is there a difference between them? According to him, once you have it extraneous on one side, you can't undermine the Gzeir Shava. So what's the difference between a Gzeir Shava with one side extraneous and two sides extraneous? Nafkamina de'echadikim mufne mitzer achad u'mufne shnei tzadim. So it's exactly our case here. We have a choice to make Gzeir Shava where both words are extraneous, or you have another option to make Gzeir Shava with one word that is extraneous. Shavkina mufke mitzer achad. We drop the one that is mitzad achad, v'yalfina mufne mishnei tzadim. And we learn the one that is mufne from the two sides, which is exactly our case, which is l'hochi, afnei rachmano the behema mishnei tzadim. The reason that the Torah made it that behema was open from two sides, keichad lo nigmar mina mufne mitzad achad. Then we don't learn it from mufne mitzad achad. And for that reason, over here, we opt to say Vayitzer. Vayitzer is the Gzer Shava, according to Rabbi Meir, and not Vayivra, Vayivra. Vayitzer, Vayitzer is Mufne Mishnei Tzadim, and Vayivra is only Mufne Mitzad Achad, and that, according to Rabbi Shmuel, is the Nafkamina between whether it's Mufne Mitzad Achad, Mufne Mishnei Tzadim, is which one you give priority to in an option to do one or the other Gzer Shava, whereas the Chachamim have a fundamental difference. You probably don't disagree with Rabbi Shmuel's position, but they also think that qualitatively the Gzeir Shav is better when it is Mufne Mishnei Tzadim, because there ain't Meshivim. This is Mitzad Achad, where you can't be Meshiv. This also just raises the issue that we discussed the other day with regards to Ein Adam Dan Gzeir Shav Me'atzmo. Over here, it seems like the Gemara has an option of which Gzeir Shav to do, and it's using the principles of Halacha to determine which Gzeir Shav it should be done. So how could they be doing that if it was only if you have a Mesorah that you have a Gzeir Shava? So again, you have to go through the explanations that we did the other day that give reasons as to what exactly it means that they had a Mesorah, what they had a Mesorah for. Clear, it's clear they had a Mesorah about some sort of Gzeir Shava for Rabbi Meir. They just don't know what the Gzeir Shava is or how it works, and maybe they're trying to search for it or find it, and they're using logic and the halachic principles to deduce what it is that Rabbi Meir said. But this is the reasoning behind Rabbi Meir's position. Some of the Mefarshim describe what the difference between Vayivra and Vayitzer is, that sometimes one is used by physical objects, one's used by spiritual objects. The truth is, in the places that they are found, we have Vayivra is in Perek Aleph, and Vayitzer is in Perek Bet, and you could describe the difference, which is the difference of Perek Aleph versus Perek Bet, which is the creation in Perek Aleph is ex nihilo, which means it's from nothing to something, and that might be the description where Vayivra is, whereas the description of creation in Perek Bet is Vayitzer, which is Davar Mitoch Davar, which is that something that exists already is being created into something else. And that's exactly the description in Perek Bet. Tzar Hashem l'kim et Adam afar min Adama. He's taking him out of the ground, as opposed to the Vayivra Perek Aleph, where he comes from ex nihilo and he's created. And similarly by the animals, Vayitzer Elohim in Adama, Kol Chayat HaSadeh Kol Ofa Shamayim. Once again, they're taken out of the ground, they're made from the ground. Now that could then match with the description of a physical creation versus a spiritual creation. But again, there are machlokot amongst the Mefarshim as to which one is which. But you can see that there is a distinction or difference between Vayivra and Vayitzer, based on the differences between Perek Aleph and Perek Bet, which give a more fundamental reason to distinguish between Vayivra and Vayitzer. And we're going to stop here, three lines down on the top of Chav Gimel Amud Aleph.